How do we work with resistance with our most vulnerable clients? As Dr. Richard Schwartz says, clients will often put up resistance to protect the injured parts of themselves. But to help them heal, Richard says you first have to go in with this one strongly worded message.
Again, probably have a different take on it than a lot of people, because for me, resistance is what I call protective parts who see it as their job to keep people, therapists, any kind of danger out of the client system. And in particular, anything that might open the door to these exile parts, these parts that are frozen in these trauma scenes or attachment injury scenes and carry all these emotions that they tried to lock away. So when clients resist, it's often because they don't want to trigger any of that, and they don't want therapy to bring that up either. And they, as they, for example, get closer to the therapist, more of that is going to be stirred up. And the idea of trusting the therapist to get that close is very scary, because if someone gets close enough, they can trigger some of that. So so resistance sometimes is, from my point of view, the correct response in a very vulnerable system to the potential intrusion of somebody that could do damage that they're not even aware of. So we have a lot of respect for the protective parts of clients that resist and can convey that to clients. And so the message to that I'll give to those protectors is, I really get your fears. Once I've learned about their fears, I'll ask, what are you afraid would happen if you let us do something, if you let us start to do this inner work, or if you dropped your guard a little bit with me, or if you didn't resist in some form? I'll go over the fears that the part has about that. And to whatever degree I can, I'll give it a lot of empathy for those fears and say, it makes sense. I'm a man, you're a woman, you have a sex abuse history. It makes sense that you wouldn't trust me. Totally, I get it. And that I'd have to earn your trust. And that might take a while. And so you're perfectly welcome to resist as much as you need and to test me in different ways, or whatever questions you have for me, I'm very open to. Again, my job is to earn your trust. And so empathy, and then the message that you're the boss. We're not going to do anything without your overt permission. And then I'll give a message of hope. But if you were willing to let us do this work, we could go in and get those parts you're so afraid of and help them heal and transform. And then you wouldn't have to work so hard to protect all the time. And the person that you're guarding wouldn't feel so vulnerable. But it's totally up to you. It's not something I'm going to impose on you at all. And that's coming from a very sincere place. It's not a paradoxical message to try and manipulate them into letting me in. That's the level of respect we have for these protectors. They have every right to keep you out until you can prove to them that you know what you're doing and that you can actually deliver on the promises you're making. So I say a lot of things to these parts that other therapists are loath to say. I'll say, we can actually do this, and I guarantee we can do it without you being overwhelmed, and so on and so on. As part of I call myself a hope merchant, as part of selling hope to hopeless systems. But it's not selling in a pressured way, because with that, I'm also saying, and it's totally up to you. You're the boss. And I get why you wouldn't trust this. And I get that probably people have made promises to you and then betrayed you. So it's really up to you. So, yeah, that's, like I said, we just have a lot of respect for resistance and for the parts that have spent their lives keeping the client safe. And partly we get much less resistance. And in fact, you know, people are amazed at how quickly I can go to these places with clients. It's because we have this respectful approach. and we honor the protectors for their service, almost like you would a military person, and learn about their sacred histories of how they got forced to be so resistant, and offer this hope. And very few parts can resist if they really believe that I could pull it off, because they don't want to resist. They just don't think it's possible. They don't think that they don't think the healing is possible, basically. And it's just safer to keep people out. I was doing a demo recently in a training, and a guy wanted to work with his anger. And so we started to talk about it and then started to focus on it. And this quote-unquote resistant part of him came up and said, no, this doesn't feel safe right now. It feels like I'm going to expose too much, and I'm not sure I know you very well. You know, it was like the first week of the training, and there's all these people watching, and so it was resisting. And so I said, okay, well, I get that, and you're the boss, like I was saying, and so if you don't want to do it, we won't do it. But if you wouldn't mind just talking with me a little about those fears. And so I asked him first about exposing himself and what kind of fears he had about that, and he was afraid of judgment if people learned about where the anger came from, and that just felt too vulnerable to let out. And so we have ways of addressing each of a resistant part's fears. So what I said was, when we do the work, you don't have to tell us what you see in there. It's for you to witness. So when a lot of the healing takes place, when these parts that have been hurt are able to feel like client self finally gets what happened to them and how bad it was, not the therapist. And that's another difference with IFS and a lot of other models. So that worked for this part, because he knew he could do it without revealing what he's seeing, but he just needed to see it. And then regarding the trust, I just asked a lot about what it would take and how I might earn his trust and what he needed to hear from me and what he might need to hear from the group. And if he wanted to look at the faces in the group to see if he detected any judgment. And so after a good deal of that, the part decided that maybe it was safe enough to give it a try. And so then we went ahead and focused on the anger and then got to the exile that it protected and did the work.
We saw how respect and trust helped move these protective parts to a place of safety. And for that to happen, there needs to be a genuine connection to the very important function of these parts. Here again is Dr. Kelly McGonigal and Bill O'Hanlon with some further thoughts on Richard's ideas.
He basically summed it up as empathy, autonomy, hope. And I thought that's exactly the kind of simple way of putting a relationship to resistance that anyone could use. And that it's in exactly the right order as well. How important it is to empathize with what you heard rather than argue with it. Give the control back to the person whose autonomy feels threatened, and yet hold the whole experience in a container of hope that change is possible. It's so incredibly useful. And I particularly like this idea that hope is something that you bring to the relationship. I don't know if merchant is the right word. Like, you don't necessarily have to sell hope, but it's sort of what you carry with it. You are the one who brings hope to the clinical situation, to the relationship. And we know when you look at treatment outcomes or recovery for all sorts of psychological issues, that one of the most important predictors is the client's growth mindset, the belief that he or she can change and that whatever he or she is struggling with, that can change, that can be different in the future. And we also know that these mindsets are contagious. So in part, even just as a clinician or as a teacher or a coach, if one comes into every single session thinking, okay, what I'm bringing to this is hope. And that's very different than a demand that a client change or a push that a client change, but simply the belief that change is possible. And now we've talked about before a concept of natural time, this idea that you actually don't have to be in charge of the timing of another person's change. And that that can give you a kind of relaxed attitude that really is better described as hope than pressure. And so the other way that I think about doing this when an individual might feel hopeless about the possibility of change is actually to link the hopelessness to hope in that individual's mind, to describe things that we know are true, that often when you're getting close to change, that's when the resistance gets strongest. That if you start to, you know, for example, often anxiety will come up right before you actually have an opportunity to do something really meaningful. And to start to allow people to reflect on their own resistance and to view it as, huh, well, maybe this is a sign that change really is unfolding. That if change weren't possible, the part of me who wants to protect myself or the part of me who wants to stay the same, like it wouldn't even be coming into this conversation because it would feel totally safe. And I think that that's a way to help support hope. That's not just about saying, well, I know you can change and I know change is possible. But actually what you're experiencing right now is part of the process of change. And it's a sign that you are moving in the right direction.
You know, I think if you work with people, especially the people we see who are the most troubled, I think you have to have some mechanism within you to have hope when things look really dark and they look hopeless. And I remember a particular client who was suicidal, like daily she was suicidal, and she lived in an apartment building up on the 27th floor, and she every day considered jumping off. And, you know, I just kept, you know, I just kept this, we can make it. We'll get through this somehow. And she told me later, she said, I had no hope and no faith. I just didn't think I was going to make it. And I thought you were psychotically optimistic, but I trusted you and you believed in me and you believed that things would get better. So I just borrowed your faith for a little while because I didn't have any. It wasn't like, you know, I had a little, I had none, but you seemed to believe I could make it. And that was good enough for me. And then later she got her own, obviously, because she did make it through. It's been, I don't know, another 15 years and she's still on the planet. So I think having that without invalidating people, you know, just being a cheerleader and everything's going to be great, just holding that, you can get through this and there is another side.
As we heard, messages of hope can be the tipping point for many clients who struggle with resistance. In the next video, we'll look at how to work with the one protective part that can sabotage growth.